This is tape two of the conversation on April 15 with Dr. Kenneth Clark. Continue. We were talking about Lincoln at our conversation between tapes. You said one judges a man by his choice of the salient issue on which he will put the big money on the card. Is that about right as a principle?
Yes, I think that each of us, from day to day and in total pattern of our lives, must make choices as to what we are going to really stand for and stand on and take the big risk for. And I suspect in the final analysis, we are judged by our contemporaries and by others on what we choose and what we consider important and salient enough to put the big stakes on, to take the big risks.
Well, Lincoln dodged the abolitionists like poison.
Of course he did.
Now, how do we judge this fact about Lincoln?
Well,
he was a unionist.
History has judged Lincoln in terms of the priority and the importance of the Union.
How do you judge it?
Well, obviously, I must now judge him on that ground because ostensibly, or on the surface, we have the Union, which he sought to preserve, and the present civil rights struggle is being fought out within a unified nation. And if you put Lincoln's decision in historical perspective, I suppose the rational and intelligent judgment is that this was a correct choice that he made.
Would you apply the same line of argument to, some hypothetical Lincoln we could produce now who would say the most immediate question is not the most immediate drive for civil rights, hypothetically say? Or at some point not go all the way you wanted to go?
Well, now,
something ahead of racial justice.
Let's not be too hypothetical, because I think we can get a rather specific example of this. Let's take the communists in World War II.
All right.
Prior to the Hitler-Stalin Pact, the communists were very concerned about racial discrimination and segregation in the United States. And they were busy telling Negroes, don't join a segregated army, you know, fight for your right to be a full American, etc. Excuse me.
Maybe cut back to Lincoln again on this matter of...
I think we were saying something just before
yes.
the phone.
Please.
Yes. I want to continue. Yes, I want to continue about the
Please.
Communists because I think they put in perspective this problem of practical and expedient determinants of what one says or what one does. After the Hitler-Stalin Pact, the communists changed their tune and their advice to American Negroes. The Nazis were not so terrible any longer. There were all sorts of justifications, and of course there were many communists who were disillusioned at that time and left the party. But when Hitler attacked Russia, in spite of the pact, then the communists were not any longer so concerned with the indignities heaped upon Negroes in a segregated army. They wanted all Negroes to go out and volunteer to fight the fascists, no matter what the conditions under which they were required to fight, you see. I mean, the same people who were trying to seduce me into the party with crocodile tears about the humiliation of segregation, etc., were now calling me, and I mean literally, the same persons were talking to me now after Hitler attacked Russia, and calling me a black chauvinist because I was still concerned with segregation. To this day, I am thankful that whatever it was that made me suspicious of them when they seemed so much on my side saved me from ever getting involved with them. Because now, on the one hand, you could say, look, you know, these people were just being practical. They were establishing what was of priority to them, you see, what was salient. To them, the relationship with Russia or the future of Russia was more important than how any individual Negro felt about being segregated.
Well, that's the way Lincoln felt about it. Lincoln couldn't have cared less, presumably, about what any individual Negro felt. He
said, frankly, I don't think that. You know, I think that Lincoln basically cared.
Well, let's take them what they were.
Yes.
I will say that I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of bringing about any way the social and political equality of the white and black races.
Do you know what I want to think about that?
What's that?
I don't believe that.
I think he said it.
But this problem of political expediency can cut both ways. One of the fascinating things, I don't know how to preface this. Maybe I shouldn't preface it. And just ask your reaction to it after I say it. I think one of the peculiar and fascinating things about some Americans is the apparent awkwardness that they seem to have in dealing with deep ethical problems. That actually they are more ethical at times than they want to pretend, you see. For example, I think the Marshall Plan. A practical politician insists upon the polls that this is a purely practical economic expediency. And would sometimes seem to be rather caught dead than offering an equally tenable rationale that this is a matter of human concern and compassion. Now, frankly, I think that this is part of the turmoil, turbulence, the conflict, the chaos that American racism imposes upon otherwise decent Americans, that they must mask or seem to go to trouble to mask their decency in order to be in a position to act decent.
Let's take William Lloyd Garrison. Now, he was certainly explicit enough. He would have damned the Union to hell and said so on the matter of abolition. Not on the matter of equality, but on the matter of abolition of slavery. After the war, he couldn't have cared less than he cared about the future of the freed Negro. In fact, he was against giving them their vote, for instance. Now, what do we make of this in that case?
I think this is another symptom of what I call the American moral schizophrenia, which is part and parcel of a Christian, democratic nation emerging and establishing a tremendous experiment in government based upon ethical ideals at the same time that it has human slavery, you see. I just don't think that America ever got over this deep ethical, moral problem, and you get these symptoms taking various forms.
It is not. But let's take a bigger jump then. If we put Dahomey and the Watusi and Abraham Lincoln and Ethiopia, the
Tamil Nadu
campaign, and the communists in the same pot, what we are coming out with is the complication of, history and ethics and politics, aren't we?
Yes, I'd put them in the same pot, but I wouldn't say that they have all become indistinguishable because they're in the same pot. Yeah. They're in the same pot in a way, but I think Americans are in a peculiar place in that pot.
Well, tell me about that.
Well, I think the peculiar thing about America is that this is the only nation that ever started out saying that it was going to develop a system of government based upon ethics. Wherever you found the ethical problem and the insensitivity problem and the man inhumanity to man problem anywhere else, you found it almost as a quote natural spontaneous expression of the animal in man, or the, you know, the problems of man. But the problem with America is that you had Jefferson, and you had Franklin, and you had these peculiar combinations of philosopher politicians, you see, who had an opportunity that most other people never had, namely to establish a philosophical and ideological base for a government.
They made the opportunity.
Well, yes, they made the opportunity on the basis of the philosophy, by the way, you see. This is the first time in, well, I don't know whether I'm exaggerating this, or maybe I'm reflecting my ignorance of world history, but I don't know that there is any other example before this of a group of human beings setting themselves the task of evolving a government predicated upon things such as rights, you know, and man's relationships and responsibilities to his fellow man, you see. Now, I submit to you that this experiment is such a glorious and frightening and awesome one that it would have had, well, I don't know, well, let me just follow this out, that it would have had tremendous impact, positive impact, were it not contaminated by the fact that as they were doing this, they themselves were the victims of the fact that it hadn't been done before. They were themselves the victims of human slavery, you see. They had the past on their backs.
But
in the
how presence. Can you abolish history? The question always coming around is this, isn't it? But how does an ethical idea develop in history? It can't be born without a history, can it?
No, it can't be born.
And therefore, there we are. We're stuck with our history, aren't we?
Well, I don't think that's exactly what the Americans... Yes, they were stuck with their history, but they were stuck with the concretization of their history in the presence of the black man.
Yeah. Thomas Jefferson was a slaveholder.
Slaveholder.
What does that mean to you? Does that invalidate the Declaration of Independence?
No, it doesn't invalidate the Declaration of Independence, but it imposes upon us levels of interpretation of that Declaration of Independence that go beyond the words. That actually you cannot understand the Declaration of Independence purely in terms of Jefferson's paraphrasing of Locke alone. You see, you have to also understand this in the context of the fact that Jefferson had slaves at the same time that he was writing this, and that he not only had slaves, but he was also aware of the inconsistency between what he was writing and the fact that he held slaves.
Do you believe in a socialist society?
Do I believe in what?
In a socialist society as an ideal?
Frankly, Mr. Warren, I don't know what I believe in now.
People who do are living in a capitalist society, make their livings in it, and yeah, doing the best they can.
No, I have stock. I purchase stock on the stock market. I believe in this capitalist society. I don't believe that it's always just or sensitive or efficient. I don't think it's always as efficient as it could be. Not even when I was young and an undergraduate in the 30s did I believe that there was a utopia in the Soviet Union, or that... I don't know why. Don't ask me why.
I never thought... Between our communism and a general socialist...
Yeah. I can't get myself at this age. I'm about to be 50. I'll be 50 this year. And at this age, I can't believe in generalized, abstract societies. You know, I believe in the inevitability of struggle. I believe that human beings will develop the most vital kind of society in those societies in which they are free to struggle toward developing the best that they can arrive at. I don't believe in fixed societies. And I'm clearly aware of the fact that I'm being incoherent now.
No, I don't think so. What do you think about Robert E. Lee after Jefferson?
Where do you get these?
Cases are better than abstractions.
I think that Robert E. Lee was a gentleman. I think from everything I read about him that he was also tortured. I think that he was a civilized human being who was again caught in this, I repeat, the inevitable moral schizophrenia that American society imposes upon all Americans, you see. And by the way, I am not using this term moral schizophrenia necessarily in a derogatory way, because I can conceive of the absence of a moral schizophrenia, which would be stagnation and death. I think, for example, the Nazis had no schizophrenia. So if you understand my allusion to the Nazis, you can understand what I'm saying about the moral schizophrenia of America. So
Lenin had no moral schizophrenia.
Nor did Stalin. Nor did a lot of the.
Nor did Robespierre.
Nor does Malcolm X. There are a lot of people who know exactly.
But you do. I do, I trust. I'm getting to feel what you do.
I don't think there's any question that.
If you speak. Isn't you say, talk about the sympathy of Lee, you are in a situation of moral schizophrenia.
Of course.
Or of Jefferson, you're in a situation of moral schizophrenia.
Of course. I have empathy for these men. Baldwin, in one of our interviews last year.
I read the book.
Yes. I remember Baldwin said something about, I asked him, was she white? He was talking about one of his teachers. And I said, was she white? He said, well, yes, she's a little bit white and a little bit colored. I don't know how Baldwin meant that. But when I heard it, I knew that it was a penetrating truth about all Americans, that they're a little bit white and they're a little bit colored. It's not possible for any American with any degree of sensitivity to be, and Malcolm X to the contrary, notwithstanding, all black or all white. There is an empathic shackle.
We have our special. You want that?
Yeah.
I suppose what I'm driving at in these questions, not a particular answer to the question, but the opening of the question of how moral absolutes, ethical ideas, relate to historical process. That's what we had sort of nagging around,
yes.
I suppose.
And I guess what we're also backing into is the realization that they don't ever determine historical process in terms of the absolutes. The absolutes themselves don't generally determine the historical process, but the constant necessity to make some kind of accommodation between or among absolutes or among forces among which might be the absolute, you see.
In that context, what does freedom now mean?
Freedom now means a demand. It means an absolute. It means an insistence. And in the future, of course, it's going to mean some kind of accommodation. But the greater the accommodation that has to be made, the greater the weakness of the total social fabric.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I don't know if it's unfortunate. It might be just is like they. There are many people who are stating and mouthing the slogan "Freedom Now," who have a rather simplistic, literalistic view of it. You see, and. maybe this too has always been true historically, that the cutting edge of any movement must, by virtue of its, I mean, like John Brown, the cutting edge has to be literalistic in order to assume that role, you see.
What do you think of John Brown, by the way?
I think he's a very powerful force in the growth and development of this country. And
he was a force, clearly. What do you think of him? How would you evaluate him morally or psychologically? Or both?
Well, psychologically, the simple designation of John Brown might be too simple. He's a fanatic, a neurotic, a literalist, an absolutist, a man who was so totally committed to his commitment that nothing, including reality, stood in his way.
How do you treat a man like that in ordinary society?
The society can take care of itself with men like that. It always has. It did to Christ.
Do you think Christ and John Brown are to be equated?
Oh, unquestionably.
Equated psychologically?
Sure. Of course.
In their values or simply in their neuroses?
In their values, in their neuroses, and of course in their end.
Christ said, I'm the Prince of Peace. John Brown lived in a dream of bloodshed. That's some difference, isn't it?
Yeah, but Christ also took, he took and ran money changers out of a temple.
The scourge. This is to be equated with the Potawatomi Massacre?
All right, don't push me that far.
We have to, though, if we're going to talk about it.
Christ was clearly a person committed to values other than those which were prevailing in his time.
Yes.
He not only was committed...
Or our time, either.
Or to our time, yes. He not only was committed, but the extent and depth and reality of his commitment was expressed by his life. You know, the fact that he lived his commitment. He did not make the primary accommodation to the realities that even some of his disciples did. All right. Christ was atypical. Christ was alienated. Christ had values that he was willing to run, positive values that he was willing to run risk for. And he paid the ultimate price. Christ, Socrates, John Brown, these people are irritating.
Let me ask you a question specifically. Suppose a man like John Brown, with the same burning eye, came into your office and said, I'm tired of this fooling around here, this matter. I'm going down to Mississippi and take six or seven strong, determined people with me, and I'm going to slaughter the governor and his entire staff in the Capitol and come out and say, rise and follow me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is almost an exact parallel.
Yeah.
What would you do about this man if he came to your office and asked you for $100 to help finance the trip?
First, I wouldn't give him $100.
Well, I would give him 50.
No, I wouldn't give him anything. I'd give him...
Would you call the police, or would you wish him well?
I don't think I would do either. I don't think I'd call the police, because
would
I...
Would you call the doctors?
I would probably try to see what I could do to help this man, if it would not inconvenience me too much, or if it would not involve me with him too much, or if it would not establish a clawing kind of relationship with him that I would not want to have, you see.
What's up to this man, this hypothetical man with the wild eye and the scraggly beard and the big Adam's apple, who comes in this office and asks you for the $100 to finance the killing of Governor Patterson and the rousing of Mississippi and John Brown going to Murray Forbes and his other friends in Boston?
Me. That's the difference. Me and
difference.
Time, you see.
All right.
That
actually I can... now. All right. So you know more about psychology than they did, that is, you see. And more about history.
Yeah.
And therefore, you were a part of it.
And not only that, I'm frank to say to you that I'm a college professor, you see. I have a vested interest in either oring. See, I have a vested interest in maintaining issues on a level of of discussion rather than action. And certainly anybody who says anything to me about bloodshed is not going to get a sympathetic response from me.
Well, he said that John Brown is like Jesus Christ psychologically.
In one respect, yes.
In which respect was this now?
The totality of his commitment, his alienation, his willingness to run risk.
But now, madmen are that way too, you see. Men and madmen are that way. So we don't make madness equal virtue, do we, automatically, on that mere point?
No, except that it isn't always that easy.
I do think we ought to explore this.
That's right. It isn't always easy to differentiate between, quotes, the madman and the martyr or the person who irritates the status quo to the point of demanding of that status quo some kind of accommodation between where it is and where he would want it to be.
If the madman happens to tie in with the moral cause and happens to have the bad or good luck to get bumped off in the process, you see.
Who else does this except madmen?
We must trust the madman, is that it, to be our moral guardians?
Let me back up a little. Madmen. Of course you could define madness as daring to believe that something which you value and believe is so important that it is worth risking your security, your comfort, or your stagnation for. You could define madness as any kind of alienation which brings you in open conflict with the prevailing values and patterns of your society. So defined, yes, I would say who else but madmen defies constituted authority or ways of life.
So we must depend on madmen.
So defined.
You're not defining them clinically now, is that it?
Now, I'm not defining them clinically because I am defining madmen to mean those who believe something so deeply, so strongly as to
suppose the man
else
is also clinically mad. Let's just assume this. Then what do we do about his relation to an idea?
Well, it's all very easy. It's extremely easy.
He's mad about it. He's clinically mad, but he also utters truths in his clinical madness or doesn't, gets tied in with an action that is... How do we get back a moral...
I'm more concerned with Van Gogh's paintings than I am with the fact that he was mad. I must confess that I will probably be more concerned with what the man says and stands for and does.
Let's take it this way now. Without, we don't know the real facts, so we can't be sure. But you judge the morality of an act by the consequences, the historical consequences, not by the nature of the act. Is that it?
Mr. Warren, you're pushing me.
Well, I have
I'm not always sure that I would judge morality of acts only by the consequences. I think that there are some acts which on their face are immoral without regard to consequences and could not therefore possibly have moral consequences. I mean, I think that even if one sought to rationalize consequences on the grounds that they were moral, these consequences would be contaminated by the amorality of the act.
John Brown's almost a test case for this.
Boy, you certainly are fascinated with John Brown, and he is one of the most...
he's a test case. Yeah. You brought him up, I didn't.
All right, I brought him up. I'm not going to abandon John Brown. You're right, John Brown was a fanatic. John Brown was mad. John Brown was a murderer. John Brown was clearly not respectable. But
How much does the word respectable take back the condemnation in the other words? You're a psychologist.
A great deal. I suppose I deliberately put respectable at the end of that.
To disinfect murder.
No, not necessarily to disinfect murder, but to deal with the fact, the reality, that respectable abolitionists were talking quite a bit, and while I would not join John Brown's party of murderers any more than I would join Malcolm X's call for a rifle club or something of that sort, I personally recoil against bloodshed because I think this is just another form of human idiocy. The fact still remains that major social changes toward social justice in human history have come almost always, if not always, through irrational and questionable methods.
That is, we have to play a double game in terms of all social movements. Is that right? We play a game of letting somebody else pick up the dirty marbles for us. That is, now the white man on his nice house in Belmead, Nashville, or in Jackson suburbs, let those cops and those rednecks pick up the marbles down there on North Ferry Street or Lynch Street while they keep it clean. Is this it? And you and I play the same game in terms of history. We're expecting the wild boys to make the big stink that gives a real threat to the our reasonable proposals. Is that it?
Well, that's one way of putting it. I would prefer not to put it that way. I would prefer to put it this way, that apparently rational, reasonable men who are seeking a change in the status quo are generally ineffectual. Changes in the status quo are more likely to come from irrational, unreasonable, questionable men.
This is the end of tape 2 on April 15 with Dr. Kenneth Clark. Continue, I hope.